that on? Oh, it's done. Okay, so what we are going to do today is to continue our discussion on NFS, and then I'll talk about two other file systems, Coda and XFS, and we'll end with a short description of the project which I put up over the long weekend. I don't know if anyone has looked at it. Okay, so I'll talk about what is required in project 3 as well. Okay, so let's continue our discussion on NFS. So as you will recall, we were talking about what are the features that an underlying file system should support in order for NFS to run on top of it. Okay, so as you remember, NFS interoperates with any type of local file system. If you have a local file system that just makes files available on your machine, you can run an NFS server on that machine and export these files to another machine. So NFS is just a way to access files on your PC, and it interoperates with a large number of file systems, okay, starting all the way from the FAT file system used in DOS to UFS, EXT3, NTFS, and so on. So in order for this interoperability to be possible, NFS must make as few assumptions as possible on what features the underlying file system support. Okay? Because if the file system doesn't support the feature, then NFS won't be able to use that or export files from that file system. So what is shown in this slide is are what are called mandatory file attributes. Okay? These are the features that NFS assumes in the underlying file system. So for every file, it just assumes that the file system can tell it what type of file it is, what's the size of the file, and some indicator to see if the file has changed or not for consistency reason. So this is the only set of features that are absolutely mandatory, okay, from the underlying file system. So as you will see, there is very little it's assuming of the underlying file system. It doesn't even assume the notion of file ownership or file access permissions and so on. Okay. So here are other attributes. These are called recommended attributes. So these are features that would be nice to have in the underlying file system, but not required. Okay, the only thing that was in the previous slide is absolutely required. So here we see a host of other things that we assume in any file system, like the access control list, the owner of the file, the access time, modification, creation time, and a whole bunch of these things. Okay, so these would allow NFS to do a better job of what it does, but they are not required. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about sharing in the context of NFS and what semantics are exported by NFS to the rest of the files, to the rest of the users. Okay, so to understand this, let's first take a Unix file system. Okay, that's our canonical example. See what features it supports in terms of sharing. Okay, so on a single machine, so whenever there is a read that follows a write, okay, the file system always returns the results of the most current write. Okay, so if you write to a file and then there's any other read that arrives at the operating system, okay, that read is going to see the most recent version of the file. Okay, because everything is just going through the file buffer cache to the disk, so any write that has already reached the file system, or in this case the operating system, is already present either in the buffer cache or on disk. Okay, so any read is going to just read those results. Okay. So that's what is shown in this picture. Now this is not very easy to do. These semantics are not very easy to achieve in a distributed file system. So here, this is an example of a file, AB. Okay, you write to it and you add a new block C, and then subsequently any other process can see this version of the file, not that. Okay. Let's look at the same example in a distributed case. This is the file server, and initially there are two blocks, A and B, in the file. Okay. This is machine 1, reads this and then writes to it. Okay. Now this blocks may be cached locally on that machine, not yet sent to the server. Okay. File has changed, but the server doesn't even know it has changed yet because there is caching that is going on here. So when this client sends a read request, he will still read this version of the file, okay, not that version. So in other words, the semantics that you had here, which is as soon as the file is modified, any other clients can immediately see those changes, are not necessarily true in a distributed file system, because clients cache data and don't tell the server as soon as the file changes. Okay? So what kinds of semantics should a distributed file system provide? Okay, so there are three that are commonly used. Okay? So the what we call Unix semantics is used in a centralized file system, which is every operation on a file is instantly visible to all local processes on that machine. Okay, this is what you expect from your machine. Okay? Now, distributed file system provide weaker semantics. So what session semantics say is that changes are not visible until the file is closed. Okay, so what in this previous case, okay, the changes to the file, these changes are sent to the server only when this process closes the file, okay, which means you are propagating modifications at the granularity or open or close, that's the session that you have established, okay, rather than individual write. So you get your local copy, it's cached, all the changes are made locally, and when you close, then you take all of the modifications and you send it off to the server. Any other client until then will continue to read the old version of the file. Okay? That's what session semantics says. Okay? Immutable files just say that any particular version of the file can only be can only be read but not written to. In other words, it's immutable. So if you write to the file, you basically create a new version. Okay? So there are many file systems that use versioning, and we will see a file system called Coda later today that also uses versioning. So what happens in versions is every time you modify a file, you create a new version for that file. Okay, so file version may increment from version 4 to version 5, and that's the version that gets modified. Okay, in other words, once a version is created, you can only read it, you cannot modify it. Modified, you have to create a new version. So you have a history of versions that the file system keeps.
So
yes.
What about the other readers who have already opened the previous version? I mean, you have one reader and one writer, and this guy has opened the same file as this guy.
Right.
And he creates a new version.
Right.
Does he read the new version or does
he? Right. So immutable. So your question is, how is cache consistency handled? This is orthogonal to what is the semantics the file system is providing. File system says data is immutable. Immutable means it cannot be modified. Okay, meaning that version of the data cannot be modified. Modified, you will create a new version and only modify that. Now your question is, how does this work when there are multiple readers and writers accessing the same file? Okay, that's the orthogonal issue of what cache consistency semantics you are providing. If you're providing stronger semantics, you will notify the cache or the client saying a new version is now available and let the client or the file system handle it. Okay, we'll talk about semantics of consistencies in a moment. This is semantics of sharing, not necessarily consistency.
So my question is this new version, when is it visible to other processes?
Right. That is again consistency issue.
But then other things are also discussing the same question, right?
So this is just saying that you will not, how is it shared? That's what you are asking. Right? So here, sharing is at the session level. Here, you have sharing at the version level. Okay, so if you are happy with the version you have, that's what you share. That's all that is saying here. Okay? The last one is called transactional semantics. So what happens here is all changes. This is somewhat like session semantics. If you treat a transaction to be a session, then it's the same. But you could define a notion of a transaction. And within a transaction, all of the modifications that you make are committed back to the file system at transaction end time. Okay? So transactional semantics becomes similar to session semantics when transaction begin maps to file open and transaction end maps to file close. Then the entire set of modifications between open and close are the same as what you have within a transaction. But transactions give you additional flexibility. You can take any set of operations and encapsulate them in a transaction. Let's say you take 3 reads and 3 writes and encapsulate them, and that would be fine. Okay? So that's what transactional semantics do. And they provide atomicity, as we have studied in the context of asset semantics and transactions, that it's all or nothing. Okay, so everything within a transaction is all committed or nothing is committed and everything is rolled back. Yeah. So these are various semantics that distributed file systems provide to us. Okay? And we'll talk about what NFS is. So in the context of NFS, we use session semantics. Okay? So as I just mentioned, and that has some implications on caching and so on that we'll just see in a moment. Okay? Now, the next thing that you have to look at in the context of NFS is locking. Okay, and so, again, centralized file system provides the notion of a lock on a file system. Okay, so you can get a lock on the entire file, which will prevent other clients from accessing that file. Okay, now this is not given to you by default. When you open a file, there's no notion of a lock. File system locking is an orthogonal functionality that is provided to you that allows you to prevent accesses on a file if you feel that that's important. Okay, all centralized file system provides some notion of locking. Okay. Now in the context of NFS, until NFS version 3, there was no notion of locking in the protocol. Okay. So if at all you had to do locking, that was outside the NFS protocol, you had to implement a separate lock manager and so on. The protocol itself did not require locking. So this meant that applications could be written that do not necessarily use locking, and you have to live with that. NFS version 4 has introduced locking as part of the protocol, and that the locking mechanisms are mentioned in this table, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. Okay. So if you use locking, right? So what can you do? You can acquire. So these are read-write locks typically. So if you get a read lock, that means that nobody can write to it until you release it. If you get a write log, that means nobody can either read or write to it while you hold the write log. Okay, that's what a typical read-write log does. And not only can you do this on the granularity of the whole file, you can also lock ranges of the file. You can say lock bytes 10 through 24. Okay, and only accesses to that part of the file are blocked, but the rest of the file can still be accessed. So you have functionality like that that any locking mechanism will provide you. So here are the primitives that are supported in NFS version 4. So lock is basically a standard lock. It creates a lock for a range of bytes. Okay, so you specify the byte range. If you say 0 through n, that's the whole file, but you can specify any part of the file and just lock that. Okay, and you can get read or a write lock there. Okay. Lock T just checks whether a lock of that type has been granted. Okay, that's just polling to check the lock. Lock U is unlock. And then renews the lease of the lock. Okay, so lock is not perpetual. So when you get a lock for a period of time, and then you have to renew it. This is to prevent a client failure. So if a client machine holds a lock and crashes, doesn't release the lock, then the lock is gone, right? So nobody else can access it. So to prevent these problems, you are given a lock for a period of time. Okay, if you don't renew it by the expiration time, then the lock is automatically revoked. Okay, meaning the server takes the lock back. So you need a renew function to keep renewing the lock. Yes.
So for this version 4, if you want to do a lock operation, whether you should suggest do the lock T at first to test that?
You can certainly do lock T to check whether someone else has gotten the lock. So that's why that functionality is there. In any case, lock is itself not blocking, so it doesn't matter. You'll just get back an error. Okay, so you could certainly check this and then do this. So saying while lock T is not true or something like that, then lock. So you could certainly do that. Or you could request a lock and then it will fail. Certainly do either of these two.
The lock is not blocking. Why do you need the lock?
I think it is to poll. I don't know why you need it, because you could certainly, but in the previous case, you can only check, but you'll also get the lock if nobody holds the lock. Here you can check, but not necessarily grab the lock. Okay, so this does both checks and acquires. This is only check. So this may be overkill if you just want to check, because you'll end up acquiring as well if the lock is available. So that's why there is that functionality. Okay. Now, none of this is supported in NFS version 3. Okay, this is also a reason why it is recommended that any application that uses locking shouldn't operate over NFS. Okay? Email is a good example. Okay? Email is an application that uses locks, as you should probably know already. So you have a mailbox on the system. This is where all mail is delivered. Okay? The two processes that accesses as the mail server, which is delivering mail into your mailbox, and a mail client, which is reading mail from your mailbox. Okay? To ensure consistency, both of these have to first grab a lock on your mailbox. Okay? Because you may be your mail client may be reading mail and you may have deleted some emails. Okay? Your mail client has to then go back and write to that inbox saying these emails have been deleted. And at the same time, the new mail may arrive and the mail server may be trying to append that mail. So to prevent conflicting operations, you have to first get locks. Okay, so any mail client or a mail server is written using locking. But since NFS version 3 does not support locking, if you just mount the mail volume, your local client, and have your mail client actually access a local file as opposed to using IMAP or something that goes to the server, you may have conflicting operations because the mail server on some machine is writing to the file and your mail client on your local machine is reading that file or trying to modify it at the same time without grabbing locks, and then you will be in trouble. Okay, this is why you will probably, if you know anything about mail servers and mail systems, they don't recommend that you NFS mount any mail volumes. Okay, that you do use IMAP or other protocols to access email. Okay, but with NFS version 4, this can be addressed. You can actually do a lock.
Can you play a lock mechanism in
the
file system?
Is there a lock mechanism? Yes, all file systems support some form of locking. Okay, so any NTFS or Unix, they will all have some locking protocols that will allow you to lock a file.
But normally we don't use lock.
Normally you don't use locks if you don't need it, but if you write an application like mail, you better use locks, otherwise you will corrupt mailboxes. Right? So any application that cares about it uses locks. So if you write a database, for example, it will use locking. Right? So you can use this kind of functionality to write a database on top of a local file system. It's going to use locks. Mail applications all use locking. But if you just write an application that is just you are accessing files, if you don't use locks, that assumes that you have either taken care of concurrent accesses or there are no concurrent accesses. Okay, so that's how you assume this is done. Okay. So NFS not only supports, or rather V4, NFS version 4 not only supports explicit locking, it also supports this notion of share reservations, which is an implicit form of locking. Okay. In a share reservation, what you do is you reserve a certain type of access to the file, and by doing so you prevent other types of accesses to the file. It's a form of, think of it as a form of read-write locking. Okay? So here is a table which I will explain how to read this table. So this is what type of request is being accessed on the file, is being requested on the file. So you're opening the file in read mode or write mode or read-write mode. Okay? This is what is being accessed, and that is what is called the file denial state. File denial state says somebody else has a reservation of a certain type, okay, and that will prevent certain operations from being allowed. Okay. So if there's no denial, meaning that nobody has any kind of log, then everything is going to succeed. All operations are going to succeed. Okay. If the file is in read denial state, that means somebody has reserved access and said nobody should be allowed to do any read, then read operations are going to fail, or read-write operations are going to fail, but write operations are going to succeed because it's in read-denial state. Okay? If it is in write-denial state, then the read operation is going to succeed because only writes have to be denied, not reads. Okay? And this one is going to fail and both are also going to fail. And if it is in both, then every other operation is going to be denied. Okay? Is this clear? What I just said? So this is an implicit form of reservation. So you can say, I reserve this file, and from now on deny all types of reads on this file. Okay, that's like saying I want a lock that will basically deny all read requests. Okay, or I want a lock that will deny write requests, or I want a lock that denies both read and write requests. Okay, is this clear? Now what the second table is showing is what happens when you try to request this type of lock. So here, the first table said if somebody already holds a particular type of lock, what types of operations will succeed and what types of operations will fail. The second table shows there are some clients that are already accessing a file and you want to request a lock of a certain type, what should happen. So this is what's called a current access state. And so what this says is somebody is already reading to the file, somebody is writing to the file, somebody is doing both to the file. Now you want to basically get a read denial. Okay? So if somebody is already reading to the file and you want to do a read denial, that isn't allowed because that client got in first and it's already reading to the file. So you can't go and say give me a lock and then deny all read requests. Okay, that just doesn't work because this client is already accessing it. Suddenly, all its requests will start failing. Okay. So you basically cause that to fail. Now, if somebody is writing to that file and you try to do a read denial, then that is also going to fail. Okay, because again, the client is writing and it already got opened the file successfully. You can't stop it in the middle. Okay, you have a question?
Sir, like if this file is already reading and we have to read it again, so in that state there will be a denial state also?
If you are already reading the file and you want to read it again?
Another application is trying to read it.
Okay. So if there is no locking involved, so typically we will assume that no, you don't get locks as was just mentioned. So if there are two clients that open a file for reading and neither of them request a lock, then both of these requests are going to succeed. Or two clients may open the file for writing and they may just start writing and overriding each other. All that is allowed. So long as you don't get locks, file system is going to allow all operations on the file. It's the application's job to ensure that you are not trampling on each other's data and all of that kind of stuff. Now, to prevent this, applications are given this locking functionality. Okay, so that's what it's saying. So only if you have gotten locks will you start denying some operation. If you haven't even bothered to grab a lock, then every operation is going to succeed. Okay, very similar to if you have a shared data structure, you are allowed to muck around with it so long as you don't get locks. Everything is allowed. Okay, but things may go wrong. But to do proper consistent access, you have to get locks, and that's exactly the same thing that the file system is also allowing you to do. Okay. Any questions here? Okay, so now let's come back to caching, which is what we have started talking about in the context of sharing. Okay. So I already mentioned that that NFS supports session semantics, not Unix semantics. So if you have any application that is assuming for any reason Unix semantics and you run it over NFS, it is not going to get the same behavior because NFS is not giving you the same semantics as local file system. Okay. Now, what does NFS do in terms of caching and session? So it turns out that NFS says that caching is allowed, but doesn't even specify what caching semantics are to be used by the client. This is left to an implementation. Okay, this was something they allowed for flexibility, but also as a result of this, what has happened is different NFS implementations may behave differently. Okay, so you could implement NFS with strong consistency because the protocol doesn't say you have to do one or the other, or you could use very weak consistency. Okay, and both of these are allowed. And you cannot assume what your implementation is going to give you, which makes it a little more difficult for application designers whenever they write distributed applications that involve sharing. Now, what is done typically by most applications, or rather not applications, most implementations, is they provide very weak or coarse consistency semantics. And most of them, like the Sun's implementation, what it does is it basically allows you to cache any data at the client end, and every 30 seconds any blocks that have been changed are sent off to the server. Okay, this is not even full session semantics. In session semantics, you have to actually wait until the client closes the file and then flush everything. Here what you do is every 30 seconds there is a daemon that runs and says what blocks in the client cache have changed, and all of those blocks are shipped off to the server. Yes. Client cache can be on disk or memory, doesn't matter really. Okay, so in this case, there's both a disk and a memory cache. So in this case, this is the NFS server. This is your NFS client. It's accessing some files and some blocks are cached here, which could be modified. Okay, the question is, when should you actually send those modifications back? So there is no consistency semantics being specified here. It just says every 30 seconds flush. Okay, so whatever that gives you, it doesn't really map to anything in particular. Okay, now NFS version 4 actually does much better. It not only specifies that you have to implement caching, but it also allows caching optimization. Specifically, it allows you this notion of delegation. Okay. Now, if you go back to the very beginning of this chapter, where we were talking about what are the two canonical models employed in distributed file system. So I said there's this remote access model and upload-download model. In the remote access model, all requests for reads and writes are sent to the server, and the server executed them. the upload download model, the first time you opened the file was downloaded locally and all modifications were done locally. So version 3 supports the remote access model and version 4 supports both. Okay, so in particular, the upload download functionality is implemented through this mechanism of delegation. So in this case, what happens is here is the server, this is the client. Okay, so the application opens the file. The NFS client goes to the server and says, I want to open the file. Now, if no one else in the system is currently accessing the file, the server may decide to delegate this file to the client. Okay, in this case, so let's assume that is true, the server delegates the file, in which case a copy is brought over to the client. Okay. At this point, all accesses become local, okay, meaning any subsequent reads and writes are actually local here. And so you don't have to send any network requests. That improves performance. Okay, the whole point of delegation is to improve performance. Okay. Now, its server keeps state of which files have been delegated to which client. Moreover, it has the right to withdraw this delegation or revoke delegation at any point. Okay. So, if there's a new client that has now opened the same file, because the server doesn't have the latest copy of the file, the only thing it can do is revoke delegation. So, it will say, give me back my file, and then the file has to be sent over. And then the server can serve other requests. Okay, so a delegation works only when, only in scenarios where clients are the only ones that are accessing certain files, in which case that file can be sent over. If there are multiple concurrent accesses to the file, then NFS version 4 falls back to the traditional remote access model, which means the file stays at the server, all requests are sent to the server for execution. Yes, question.
Client fails over here after getting delegation.
Yeah, so good question. So what happens if that client fails? There is very little you can do. I mean, you still have the old file. You just assume that there are no modifications. So basically you deal.
In the scenario where it is doing remote access, does it do any caching?
Yes, so in the remote access it looks exactly like NFS version 3.
Right.
So the same question that you asked is valid even here. There's a cache here and you made some modifications and the client crashes. The server doesn't ever, never gets to know that there are modifications. It just continues to use the old version. Same is true of delegation. Okay, so delegation has to be done using a lease, which means you're delegated the file for a certain period of time. Okay? If the client crashes and that period passes and the server assumes that this is the file that it had as the most recent version. That's it. Yes, because of backward compatibility, you can't go and suddenly change things because you have lots of applications that have already been written, they will break. So they can only make incremental changes, which is exactly what they have done. They haven't added new semantics, but they have added performance enhancements. Okay. But at least caching is explicitly part of the protocol. That's the point I wanted to make. In NFS version 3, there's no mention of caching. Does say, all we have said, NFS doesn't prohibit it. So you can do whatever you want. That's the whole point. Here, there's mention of caching and delegation and whatnot in there. Yes, question there.
You're saying the whole file is sent back and forth between the server and the client?
Yes, in upload download model, the whole file comes over here and then all accesses become local. In the previous case, only parts of the file that you accessed are cached. So in this case, as soon as delegation just says you can delegate the whole file. Not only that, there's directory level delegation. If you basically access a directory, all the files in that directory can be delegated. Okay, any other questions here? Yes.
So who decides if it's done through delegation or through remote access?
Right. So who decides? That's a good question. Who decides whether to do it as delegation or remote access model? So that responsibility is on the server. Now there are many policies it could use. Right. So when the file open comes, okay, the client never asks for delegation. The client has just sent an open request. At this point, the server has to decide, should I just let the client open the file and use remote access, or should I just send the file over and say, you deal with it for some period of time. So it can use various policies saying, is this file heavily accessed? Has anyone else accessed it in the recent past? Is anyone accessing it now? Based on this, you can come up with a policy saying if all of the answer to all of this is no, I'm going to delegate the file. So it will decide, okay, I'm willing to delegate, but do you want it? client can refuse it. If it's a version 3 client talking to version 4 server, it doesn't have delegation support, so it's not going to do anything. It'll just say, I'm going to use the old mod. But if it's a version 4 client, it can say, fine, I'm going to accept the file. File comes over, you access it locally, you send it back. Okay? So all of these policies are implemented in the server. Now it's interesting that version 4 doesn't tell you when to delegate. It just says that there has to be a delegation mechanism. The delegation policy is left to the implementation. Just as the caching policy was left to the implementation, it doesn't say when should you say yes or no. If there's a conflict, that's a clear no. But beyond that, when to say yes, it doesn't specify. Again, so different implementations are going to do different things.
So implementation-wise, you do some statistical method
and something? Yeah, that's up to the implementation. So you can think of any of these ideas and say my implementation is going to do this and it's going to be better than other implementation, right? This is how these things compete with one another. Any other questions on delegation? Okay. So the last thing is failures in the context of NFS. In particular, we'll look at failures at the granularity of RPC failures. Okay, so as I have already mentioned, NFS runs on top of RPC. So any communication between the client and the server is through RPC. We looked at all of these requests like open, create, read, write. I showed you this large table. Each of them is an RPC call that you make to the server. Okay. Now, things can go wrong when you do RPCs. So we have to ensure that the client and the server can still work despite RPC failure. Okay. In particular, early versions of NFS ran over UDP. Okay, UDP just gives a connectionless datagram protocol where there are no retransmits, no reliable delivery. So you send a packet, it may or may not show up at the server end. Okay, or the server may send you a reply, it may or may not be received. There's no retransmissions or no acknowledgement that are part of UDP. So in this scenario, it's the job of the NFS server and the NFS client to detect when either RPC requests or responses get lost and recover from them. Okay. Now, version 3 and on, NFS also runs over TCP. Okay, if you run over TCP, then failures are not a problem because TCP takes care of the retransmissions. Okay, but since the code does not assume you have to run over TCP, you have to include failure handling code in NFS. Okay, that's what is done here. So what you typically do is every RPC request gets a sequence number, so that request can be tracked uniquely within the system. Okay, so here is your so that's called a transaction ID, which is XID. Okay, so every request, an RPC request to make, gets a unique transaction ID, unique between the client and the server. Okay, so the server can track it. So what is shown here is a scenario where the request reaches the server. Okay, and but the server is slow. So the client times out because it hasn't heard back from the server and it repeats the request. So the same request is sent again. Okay. So how should the server handle this scenario? You have received the same RPC request multiple times. Okay. Now, as I already mentioned earlier, you need the server to ensure some form of idempotency. Right. So if you repeat the request, you don't want bad things to happen. Okay, so file creation is a good example. If that RPC request was to create a file, the first request has succeeded. If it repeats the second request, since the file already exists, that create is going to get an error. But that's the wrong response because it was the same request. Okay. So to prevent this, what the server does is it keeps a cache of RPC responses. Okay, so any request that is processed, okay, the response that was generated is kept in the cache. Okay, so whenever a request comes in, you see, have I seen this transaction ID before? Okay, did I generate a response, and if so, what was it? So you look in the cache. Okay, so in this case, since the request was received, okay, it will be logged in the cache and the response will be logged. So when the next request comes, you don't execute the request. You simply send back the response that was generated in the cache. Okay, so you are emulating idempotency by not repeating operations that are already done. Okay. Real idempotency says that any number of times you can repeat that operation, you'll get the same result. But you can't guarantee that in a file system. Okay, because I could say append 10 bytes to the file. If I do the append twice, I'm not going to get the same response, right? I mean, I've done two appends instead of one. Okay, so you have to detect that whether the operation has been successful or not. And if it was successful, you just send back the response to the previous operation, okay, rather than repeating the operation. Yes, question.
Is there an transaction mechanism to get the unique transaction ID between the server?
Yes. Is there a handshake mechanism? No. So you just assume that the client is taking care of that. So this is unique to a client and a server, not unique system-wide.
I know, but how do you ensure that this transaction ID 1234 is unique to the server?
I mean, not to the server. It has to be unique to the client. Because you can append a client identifier to it, right? So say client 1, transaction 1234. Client 2 can also 1234, doesn't matter. Right, because it is coming, you know which server, which client is sending it. So that's all you need to ensure. Okay. The third scenario shows where the reply is lost. Okay, so in this case, when you send back the request, you look in the cache and you just send back the reply to them. So that's basically what is done. Okay, so this is called a duplicate request cache. Because it is basically logging responses, so you can detect duplicate requests and not redo them. That's what it does. Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about here is security. So how is security between the client and the server ensured? So until version 3, yeah, there was very little in the form of security. All communication between the client and the server was on vanilla TCP, unencrypted. Which means if you're snooping, you can see all the blocks that are being written. Right? So you may be doing something sensitive. You may be writing a document that you consider sensitive. Okay? You have mounted an NFS volume. You hit save. That document is going unencrypted over your network to the server. Okay? Somebody has access to it. You can see what files are going back and forth. Okay? So no encryption between the client and server until version 3. And moreover, authentication was also very simple, which was user ID, group ID. Okay, so basically, client sends a request to the server saying, this is the user that is making the request. Okay. Server just checks, does this user have access rights to that file or not? If so, you allow access to the file. Okay. So this is what you do in a local file system also. Right? When a process or a user opens a file, you check whether he or she has access rights to the file, and if so, you allow it or deny it. Okay. Same thing is done here. But in this case, this mechanism is broken, or is the claim. So why would this cause trouble? So different user ID is different. So that's some valid point. But let's assume that's not even the case. Let's assume user IDs are, we'll come back to different UIDs and what they can do. Assume UIDs are all uniform. Everyone in the whole system has the same user ID. Yeah. So the question is, well, this can be, you are depending on the client to be trustworthy and not fake user IDs, right? So if the client is broken, in particular, if I have root access to my Linux box and I'm accessing an NFS server somewhere, I can get access to any file on that server by forging my UID. Okay, so I can just change my UID to someone else's UID in the kernel. Okay, because kernel, if I have root access, I can modify the kernel. And I can just send that UID to the server. Server is not doing any authentication. It is just depending on the client to send it right. So the trust level is extending to the server, client in this case. Okay, if the client is not trustworthy, then you can get access to any file on the server by forging the UID. Okay, so that's a problem because there is. And then there is another problem that was mentioned, which is more also doesn't even require forgery. It just says different machines have different UIDs. Okay? So I may have UID 10 and someone else also has UID 10 on some other client. If both of them mount the same volume, whenever that client makes a request, it's sending a number 10. Okay? And that gets access to my files because I also have 10. Okay? So although I may be reading a file, somebody else also gets access to the file. So there are problems like this that can crop up when you use simple UID, group ID authentication. Yeah, forgery and mismatches of UIDs and so on. Yeah, is this clear? So in other words, you have to ensure that all machines are trusted or trustworthy under the same administrative domain, which means users don't have root access, or even if users have root access, they are not doing malicious things. So that's a assumption that is made in case of NFS. If that is broken, then you can break security as well. Now version 4 has more stronger authentication and security and so on. So in particular, it can use secure RPCs which allow you to encrypt whatever is the content of the RPC payload and send it. Okay, so first of all, communication between the client and the server can be encrypted if you want it to be. Okay, all that secure RPC does is encrypt the payload, just as you had HTTPS, which was secure sockets. You're just encrypting the payload, so even if you're snooping the traffic, you don't know what is in there. Okay, you cannot guess the contents of a file reads and file writes and so on. Okay, and then it also has other forms of authentication like Kerberos are supported, which is mentioned here. So there are stronger authentication and stronger encryption that version 4 supports to get around this problem. And that's the thing to keep in mind. And the last thing to keep in sort of mention here, but I'll not go into the details, is that NFS also supports replication. Okay, so here what happens is there are multiple servers that are replicating the volume, and you can get your file from any of those servers. So here is an example where you have two servers, both of them slash user, okay, that's tree, and they replicate it. Okay, the client mounts both, okay, so this is a replicated NFS volume, and a request can then be sent to either one. So depending, if you might want to use this for load balancing, you can do round robin. You can send the first request here, second request here, so the load on the server is split, just as we had done replicated web server. Same thing as you can do in the case of NFS. Okay, So replication is supported. Entire file systems can be replicated, not individual files. You can take a whole volume and replicate it, and then any of the server can then service requests for the file. Okay, this adds a new attribute for each file, which is the location attribute. It says which set of servers is it stored on. Is it on one or multiple? Then you can get access to that file on either server. Okay. Now there are a lot of implementation specific details here. Okay, so NFS replication is only used for read-only volumes, okay, to get around the consistency problem. Because as I mentioned, consistency is not really part of the protocol. Okay. So you can do replication. But now if you write to one, okay, it is the implementation's job to figure out how to update the other. Okay, and this is quite messy in many cases. So this form of replication is used for load balancing. So suppose that you have slash users, that is accessed by 100 clients. Okay, so that server is going to be a bottleneck. So you can take slash user and replicate it on multiple servers, and the load that this 100 client generate is now spread across this server. This may be all binaries that the clients don't really need to write. They only need to read it. Okay, these are all my programs in slash user slash bin, for example. Okay, so that's a typical use of replication in most practical settings. Okay, so now we are going to switch gears and look at another file system called Coda. And I'm going to go through this relatively quickly, not spend as much time as we spend on NFS. So let's start with the philosophy. Okay, what is different? What was it designed for? So Coda was designed for scenarios where, the best way to put it is Coda was designed for mobile computing scenarios. So the assumption was that users are going to have laptops. Okay? Laptops are going to come and go out of the environment. So you cannot assume that the laptop, which is a client, is always connected to the server. Okay? And you want to provide a distributed file system that explicitly supports all of the issues that crop up when you have mobile clients. Okay? In particular, mobile clients can come and go. Okay? And you want to keep allow accesses to the file even when the client is not part of the network, which means you want to allow caches to be present on the file, so I can just take a cached version of my home directory with me. Okay, so I go off on a plane, I have no network access, yet all of my files are on my machine. Okay? At some later point, I can reconnect. At that point, the client and the server can resynchronize, and all changes that I made while I was away are sent to the server. All changes that the server received are sent to me. So all of this is now part of the file system. Okay. This we now, without the file system supporting this, we do this manually. Okay. If you are going to go on a trip, you probably download all the files you want and you take it. And then when you come back, you upload the changes manually. Right. So this is now handled by the file system itself. You don't have to do all of this. It's all automatic. This part of the file system. So that is one feature, and it's supporting environments that that are mobile computing specific. The other thing that it supports is replication. Yeah, this is also to deal with failures and network partition. And we'll see how all of this works. So here is a file server. Because the default assumption here is that files are always replicated on multiple volumes. Okay, so this is a file server. And there are files here that's replicated on this other file system here. Okay. Now, how does the client know where the file is and which set of servers to access? So what is done is each file belongs to only one volume, but it's replicated. So multiple logical volumes will map to the same physical volume. And the way you figure out which servers actually have your file is through the file identifier. Okay. Every file has a unique identifier. So it's a 96-bit identifier. And the first 32-bit tells you which servers actually hold a copy of your file. The last 64-bit tells you which file it is on that server. Okay, so there is a volume ID, and then there is this file handle. Okay, and what is shown there is how the volume ID actually gives you the server. Right? So here is this 96-bit handle that you want to access a particular file. Okay, so you take a volume ID, and then you do a database lookup and say, which machines actually have a copy of that volume. Okay, so let's say the volume is /home. Okay, this is the volume that stores my home directory. This is given a 32-bit number. Okay, so this has a 32-bit RV ID. So to open a file in my home directory, I just first look up the volume ID. Then I look up the volume database, replication database, saying which machines have a copy of this. Okay, so here, you basically get back the answer saying it's server 1 and server 2. Okay. So then I take the server ID and I stick it into the file handle. And then I have a file handle which says on this server, go look up that file. Okay, or on that server, look up that file. Okay, so then I can go and access the file from any of those servers that are still accessible to me. Okay. Yes.
How is the replication issue tied with the mobile computing thing? Like why do you want to support it?
Yes, so I'll show that in just one moment. So let me jump ahead there. So here is an example. So you want, so there are two things here. In mobile computing environment, you assume what is called weak connectivity. Weak connectivity says that the network can get partitioned at any point. Okay? In the case of a laptop, basically the connection from your machine to the rest of the world is what got partitioned. Okay, so you got disconnected from the network because you went on a trip. There is no network there. But the file system doesn't necessarily make just that assumption. It assumes that any link anywhere can break and there will be network partitions. Okay, the extreme form of network partition is only where your client disappeared from the network. So here is a scenario where there's an arbitrary network partition. So that server and this server, they're replicating the same volume. They cannot talk to one another anymore. Okay, so typically, this is a client getting disconnected, but anything can get disconnected is the assumption, which is why you have replication. So in this case, there are two servers that replicate the same volume, and they can continue to serve files to clients within their partition, okay, even though there is a network partition. So that's the basic idea. Okay, so let's come back to replication. So is this clear, what I just mentioned? Okay. So sharing files. So we talked about semantics, right? So in case of Coda, what we have are transactional semantics. Okay, so you basically assume that when you do a file open, the entire file is sent over to the client, which is similar to delegation. And then you are basically saying the session is same as a transaction. So you basically wait for the whole file to be accessed and the file to be closed. At that point, the transaction also ends. Okay, and then you have to then send all of the changes back or none of them. Okay, so that's the basic idea. We'll talk about what happens when there are conflicts. Okay, the reason this works well is it allows you to detect file conflicts and so on, which I'll talk about in a moment. So here is a scenario where you're sending an explicit invalidate. Okay, so what has happened here is you have opened the file. Let's open with a read, and the file is sent over to that client. you know, that client has a copy of that file.
Oops.
Okay. So now client 2 has made a write request of the file. Okay. So the file is again sent over to this client. Okay. So now at some point this file is modified and it is closed. So that file, new version of the file is sent off to the server. Okay. Now the server explicitly knows who is caching what. So if that client is still connected to the network, it will send an invalidate and say, I have a new version. That was a question you asked in context of NFS. Coda has explicit support for it. NFS does not. Okay. So you send an invalidate and you tell client 1 saying, whatever you cached, that's no longer valid. I have a new version. Okay. So client can do whatever it wants, saying, send me the new version, or it will tell the application saying file has changed or some such thing. Okay. But server will send this invalidate. Now again, as is shown here, this is done at the granularity of sessions which are transaction, not the first time you read this. The file actually becomes invalid the first time you write to it, but you are going to send notification only at transaction end or session end time. Okay, so that's the granularity of consistency. Any questions on this?
In one curse oblation of one duplication, we are cause another.
It will. So question is, will one close cause another thing to be closed? So one close, if you do a close after modifying the file, okay, and the file is now sent back to the server. Okay, this is again delegation, right? So here you had a local copy, you modified it, you sent it to the server. Server knows it has a new copy, so it is going to send notifications. These are called invalidates to all clients that have cached copy. What the clients do with that notification is up to them. Okay, whether they close the file or they get a new copy of the file is all up to them. Okay, but they are told that the file is changed. You know, depending on the application that they are running, they have to do the right thing. Okay. So, that's what transactional semantics is. So, I also mentioned that all of this has to work even when clients are disconnected. Okay, so in the previous scenario, you may have a scenario where that's a laptop. Okay, so the laptop has actually gotten a cached copy of the file and has gotten disconnected. So when this file is closed, this invalidate cannot be sent to that machine because the machine is not on the network at this point in time. And yet this should all work, because at some later point when the client reconnects, at that point it has to figure out. Okay, it won't be sent an invalidate at that point, otherwise the server will have to maintain indefinite state. But at some later point, it has to detect that the file had changed, because it didn't get the invalidate, but it has to figure out it has changed and do something about this. Okay, so in the context of file partitions, you reconcile upon reconnection. When you reconnect, you have to detect of all the files that are modified, did anyone change, and that will create a write-write conflict, and you do something about this. Okay. The other thing is, since these are transactional semantics, we want to ensure this serializability. Okay, we talked about this in the context of ACID semantics. You want to ensure that any operations to the file are serializable, which means transaction 1 went before transaction 2 and so on. So that ensures consistent access to the file. You don't want interleaving of writes to cause problems. Okay, that is the other thing. Yeah, so now I'll show a little bit of how this is. So this is not the right example to show. Okay, so this is the example that shows how to handle network partitions. Okay. So the basic default assumption in Coda is we will use transactional semantics, okay, but we are going to use optimistic concurrency control. Okay, if you remember transactional semantics when we did databases, so there are two forms of concurrency control, optimistic or pessimistic. In pessimistic, you need locks. In optimistic, you let clients do whatever they want. At transaction close time, you see, did someone else modified? If so, you basically abort the transaction. Okay. Because there are network partitions involved, you cannot use pessimistic concurrency control. Because I may be disconnected and I'm trying to modify a file, I cannot get a log because there's no one to contact. Okay. So the only thing that works in this context is optimistic concurrency control and an optimistic strategy for replication. So any client is allowed to access any file, okay? And when the transaction ends, at that point you detect, is there a conflict? The conflict occurs where two clients try to modify the file at the same time. Okay? So you want to detect this scenario and don't let them overwrite one another. Okay, so what happens is we use what is called a version vector to detect whether there is even a conflict. Okay, so in the version vector, what happens in this case is every server keeps track of the version of the file. Every time the file is updated, you increment the version vector. So you basically, by looking at the version vector, you can now detect that there is a conflict. So in this case, the version vector is 2 to 1, which means server 1 has version 2 of the file, server 2 has version 2, server 3 has version 1, and that's because there's a network partition there. Okay? And then, so let's assume for in this case that when the version was 111, the network partition happened. Okay? So here client A has access, returned to the file. So these two servers have seen that update. So the version that these two version vector here becomes 2 to 1. Okay? And then client B is also accessing the same file. So when it writes to it, this server 3 updates its own version number, but it doesn't know about the other updates yet. Okay? So here the version number is 112. Okay? So when the network, when the network partition is rectified, then these servers start talking to one another. And when they look at this version vector, they can detect that I saw some changes and you saw some changes. So there were independent modifications to the file. This is referred to as a write-write conflict. Okay, because there are multiple writes that conflict with one another. Okay? Now this is detected. And then you basically ask the user, what do you want to do? Because the system cannot figure out what's the right thing. Which of these writes, only one of these writes can succeed, not both. Right? So you have to figure out what to do with this, how to reconcile these write-write conflicts. Okay, this form of conflicts are also used in a variety of other scenarios, right? So if you use any source code control system like CVS or SVN, multiple people can check out source code from your repository. And if they then make modifications to the same file, the system will raise a conflict and say, somebody else modified this code while you are doing it. You figure out how to merge the code or do something, override one another. So you throw it back to the user. Same is true of shared calendars. Okay, you may have a calendar that you share with someone else. So you put an appointment and they put an appointment at the same time. Since you can only go to one of these two, the calendaring system is going to ask you, saying you have multiple appointments that are booked for the same time, which one do you want to keep? Right? So any write-write conflict can only be handled by the user of the application. If the file system doesn't know which write is more important or how to merge it. Okay, yes, question.
Yes, so how do you know how many servers or replicas are there, especially if it's going to partition and reconnect?
Right. So how many servers and replicas are there? So each volume is replicated on a fixed number of servers, right? That's what we're talking about. So that is encapsulated by the volume identifier. There's a replication, volume replication database that says slash home is replicated on these N servers. This is known in advance. So this database, although it is actually shown as a machine, it is cached on every single machine. Right? Otherwise, if you disconnect, you cannot access the volume data. But this is a small amount of data, although it's called a database. It's actually not that. There are only going to be so many volumes. Okay, and then it doesn't change very frequently either. Okay, does that answer the question? Okay. So the extreme form of this scenario, so here I just showed a network partition that caused servers to get disconnected, okay, the replication volume. The extreme form of this is where the network partition actually happens here. One client just got disconnected. This is you take your laptop off the network, okay, and you want the system to behave exactly the same way. Okay, so how does that work? So here is a state machine that says what is happening with your client. Okay, so there are three states your machine can be in, your client machine. It can be in the holding state. In the holding state, you are connected to the system and you are busy downloading files because you assume that you can get disconnected, so you want to update your cache. Okay, so that's what is called holding. You hold a copy of all the files that are of interest to you. Okay? And then there's an emulation state and there's a reintegration state. So from the holding, if you actually pull your machine off the network, you go into emulation state. Okay. In emulation state, what happens is you really don't have a connection to the server. So your local copy starts behaving as if it is the file server. Okay. So you basically emulate that there is a server, but this is not the real server. Your cached copy starts behaving as if it's the file server. So all applications continue to behave exactly the same way. Okay, they don't start seeing problems because you've gotten disconnected, because all the files are still there. You're just accessing local copy instead of going to the server. Okay. This is emulation, and every time you do a write, you will then update your version vector and so on. So you will know whenever the version changes. At some later point in time, you are going to connect back to the system. Okay, at this point, you're going to reintegration state. So then you take your cache, see what files have changed. You talk to the server and say, these are the files that were changed. Should I send them to you? Or are there conflicts? Okay. You will compare the version vector. And if you are the only client that modified the file, the server will accept your change. Okay. If someone else modified some files that you also modified, this will trigger a write-write conflict. Then that is thrown back to the user saying, somebody modified it, you figure it out. Okay, you figure out which version to keep and so on. Okay. So once reintegration is completed, you will go back to holding. But you may disconnect while you are reintegrating, in which case you will again go into emulation. So that is why there is a loop here. Okay. But once you have figured out everything, all the files have been sent over, you will go back to holding state, at which point you start caching more data. Yes.
Prefetch all files, I mean, the
logic
some files got missed out.
Yes. So that's a good question. You cannot prefetch everything, because you can't take the whole file system with you, otherwise, then why did you have a file system if you had so much this way, right? So it is only going to keep caching what you have access. So that's again a policy decision, what to cache, right? So maybe you cache your home directory by default, maybe you cache your mail spool or your inbox by default, but other things the file system can say. Maybe you share a project directory with your project partner. Okay? So once it detects that you're accessing this, the next time it will start holding that. So it keeps track of what you're accessing and automatically decides what to hold. Okay, you can also manually say, I want to take a copy of this directory. Then it will hold that.
So how does it handle emulation for a file which is not
prefetched? So it will basically throw an error. Okay, so if you haven't cached the copy, there's nothing you can do. It will just say, I don't have the file. Okay, any questions here? Okay, so that is all that we have to talk about Coda. I'm going to talk about one last file system called XFS, which is again, so you can probably see how Coda is different from NFS. The design decisions were different, the philosophy was different. And here is yet another file system called XFS, also a distributed file system. And this uses yet a completely different philosophy from NFS and Coda. Okay. So X in file, XFS stands for no server. X is just a crossing, there's no server. It's also referred to as a serverless file system. Okay. Meaning that there is no client and there is no server in the system. All machines can take on any of the responsibility of the client and the server. Anyone can be a server and anyone can be a client. Okay. So what this says is machines are powerful. They are connected by powerful LANs. So any machine can do any job that the server could do. So why have a distinguished machine? Let us just distribute the responsibility of the server across all of the machines in the system. That is the basic idea behind XFS. So this is a research file system. It never made it out to any commercial version. Right? But nevertheless, it used some interesting optimizations that are worth talking about here. Right? Now, here it has explicitly assumed that you are using high-speed LANs. This is not mobile computing anymore. It's assumed you have gigabit Ethernet in an office environment. There are desktops that are always connected, and they have large disks. They have powerful CPUs. So why not use some of those capabilities and basically use this as a serverless file system? Okay. An extreme form of this is a P2P file system. If you're using P2P, that is sort of like XFS, although XFS is a lot more structured. A P2P file system, any client can be a server for all the files that are stored locally, and it is a client for files that are stored elsewhere. Same thing is true in XFS, okay, but there's a lot of metadata. It's a real file system. P2P file systems are not file systems in that regard. They're file sharing systems, not file systems. Yes, question. Yes. Question is, can machines come and go? They can. Yeah, but there is some responsibility that is given to a more trusted set where the lifetime of those machines are supposed to be long. Other functionality can be distributed to machines that can come and go. Okay, so that's one thing that I do want to mention here. Okay, now there are two important things that XFS uses that are based on previous file system. Okay, one technique is called striping. Okay, striping is here. So the one technique is called striping, and the other technique is called a log structured organization. Now, there were earlier file systems. There was one called LFS, which introduced the notion of a log-structured file system. XFS uses it also. Okay. There were other file systems and other systems that introduced the notion of striping. Okay. There was a system called Zebra, which was a network stripe file system. There are disk arrays like RAID arrays that also use striping. So that technique is also used in XFS. And what I'm going to do is give a quick overview of both, okay, before we actually look at how XFS uses them. So there are two things to keep in mind. So we'll talk about striping, it's a little easier. Okay. So striping is a way of distributing a file onto multiple disks for performance reasons. Okay. Typically in a file system, you have a single disk. The entire file is stored on that disk. In striping, what happens is there's not one, but more than one disk, as is shown here. And the file is chopped up into smaller pieces, and pieces are distributed across these disks in round robin order. So here is a simple example where your file has three disk blocks. Okay? So you chop the file into three blocks. Store block one on disk one, block two on disk two, block three on disk three. Okay? So your file is no longer on a single disk. Pieces of it are scattered across multiple disks. And this technique is referred to as striping. You're striping the file or storing the file on multiple disks. Okay. Now, what does this give you? Why would you want to do something like this? Why not keep the whole file on a single disk?
Faster reads.
Okay. This is going to give you faster reads, because if you want to read the whole file, you send requests in parallel to your disks. Okay. And you can retrieve the file in parallel. If the whole file was on a single disk, you have to retrieve the blocks in sequence. Okay. So better performance is one advantage. Okay. What other things does it give you? So error recovery is mentioned. So I'll talk about error recovery in a moment. That is indeed true, but not without additional techniques. Are there other things that a striping is going to give? Granularity, what does that mean?
Maybe can introduce little conflicts when someone has modified some part of the file.
At the file system level, you still have to deal with conflicts and so on, right? So that is not going to change by just scattering the file across multiple disks. Doesn't prevent you from multiple clients from accessing it. You still have to do that. Any thoughts? What is? We'll talk about that in a moment. So the other thing that this gives you is load balancing, right? Because you are spreading the load across multiple disks. If you had single disk systems, you would probably store, let's say, home directories for user 1 and 2 on disk 1. Maybe home directories of users 3 and 4 on disk 2. Okay? Some users may be more active than others, in which case the load on one disk may be higher than others. Or disk space on one disk may fill up faster than the other. Okay? So then you have to rebalance the system by moving files and so on. Here all files are stored on all disks. Okay? So the load is equally spread out. Also disk space is all used up by all volumes, because they're all stored on all the disks. So you get load balancing as another advantage. Okay, so now let's talk about error recovery. So the disadvantage of striping is that it makes the system more vulnerable to failures. Okay? So if you had the entire file system stored on a single disk, if this disk dies, only files on that disk become unavailable in the normal case, because other disks are still available, those files are intact. Now here, all files are stored on all disks. So if one disk goes down, pieces of all files disappear. And every file has some data that has disappeared. In the previous case, if the entire file system was on this disk and another one here and another one here, these two file systems are untouched. Only that one goes away. Okay, now every file becomes vulnerable to failures. Okay. And the probability of failure also increases as you have increased the number of disks. Okay. So whenever you have striping, you also have to ensure better reliability of your system. Otherwise, a single disk failure impacts everything. Okay. So people who designed striping techniques also designed better reliability for the system, and that is done. So that's that gray block that is stored here. That is done by redundancy, because we have to add some redundant data in order to tolerate single disk failures. Okay. The simplest form of redundancy is mirroring. Okay. So in this case, you have, let's ignore these two disks. So whatever is stored on this disk is mirrored on the other disk. Okay. So if this disk goes down, you still have the backup copy. But that is expensive because it acts a factor of 2 increase in disk cost. Okay. So better reliability techniques use what are called error correcting codes. Okay. The simplest form of this is a parity. Okay. So what you do, you take each bit that is stored here, take an XOR of this bit and you store it there. Okay. So that gives you redundant information. So let's suppose you have block 1, block 2 or bit 1, bit 2, bit 3. So if you do an XOR of this, you get what is called a parity bit. Okay. The reason this is gives you redundancy is if any of these fail, you can take the other two, take the parity bit, you XOR it, you get the other one back. So if the C goes down or whatever, this other C stored goes down, then C can be reconstructed by accessing A, B and P and doing an XOR that gives you C by simple XOR operation. Okay. So that allows you to tolerate single disk failures, because if this disk goes down, if you want to access this block, get that block, that block, that block, do an XOR, that gives you this block back. Okay. So this is used by disk arrays, and that's where RAID comes in. This redundant array of independent disks. Okay, so all RAID systems, and this is also referred to as RAID 5, okay, RAID level 5, because you're keeping parity information. Okay, so this is basically what striping does. And in particular, XFS uses what is called network striping. So what that means is these disks, although I've shown them as logically as logical disks, these are on independent machines. Okay? So this will be on server 1, this disk is on server 2, this disk is on server 3. So when you employ network striping, you chop up a file into multiple blocks and you send the first block to server 1, okay, second block to disk on server 2, third block on disk on server 3 and so on. Okay? In RAID, all disks are on the same machine. You're doing the same thing, but you're not striping across a network. You're striping across an array of disks. Okay? It's the same concept, but in network striping, you're striping or distributing these blocks over a network across independent machines. Okay? So disks are now in network striping on different machines. In disk arrays, all these disks just sit on a disk pack on the same machine. Okay? So XFS, first optimization, network striping. Okay? This allows you to use the disk space on multiple machines efficiently. It also allows you to do load balancing. All of those advantages are still true. The load balancing across servers, you get parallelism. To access a file, multiple servers can retrieve those blocks in parallel. So all of those advantages are true. So next time I will talk about what a log structured organization is and how XFS uses it. Okay? So before you go, I just want to spend 2 minutes talking about the project. Okay, so again, I did put up the project on the course web page. Okay, it's due in 3 weeks or approximately 3 weeks, so you should have plenty of time to do it. And the basic idea in the project is to use replication. Okay, so it's the continuation of what we have already done, but it adds replication, caching, and fault tolerance to the picture. Okay, so the same idea, you have two tiers. Tier 1 and Tier 2. Okay, so we'll assume that in the first part, there are two parts. Tier 1 is replicated. So this was already done to some extent in the previous case. Okay, you already replicated your request, but here we want you to do a little more. We want to add some cache consistency and so on. So what is assumed is there's a load balancer. So all clients send their request to the load balancer. And so these are the replicas, there are k of them. So the load balancer then forwards this request to one of these replicas. So you can use any load balancing policy you want. Round robin is the simplest one. Every request is sent to server I plus one. You could do something smarter. You can actually keep track of how many requests are being processed or the load and send it to least loaded. Okay. Policy is up to you, but you have to implement load balancing of some sort. Okay. So in the first part, you send a request to one of these servers, and then you still have one copy of the catalog and the order database, and then these would just access the catalog, send back. So that all of that is the same. Okay. So you have to, the other thing is, you also have to add a cache at each of these tiers. Okay. So in particular, you had this lookup request, right? The lookup request allows you to specify a book, and then it gets the cost of the book and the number of items in stock. Okay. So you cache that here. Okay. So whenever a lookup request comes, you first look in the cache. If it's cached, you just send that reply back. You don't even go to the database. Okay. So you added a cache to reduce load on the database. So replication is giving you performance. Caching is reducing the load on that server. Now, you also have to implement cache consistency. Because you may have cached a lookup request here, this guy actually does a buy request. Okay? Now, the number of items in stock has gone down by one. Okay? But you are already caching that information here. So you implement some form of cache consistency to ensure that you will not serve stale data. Okay? Now, again, what cache consistency scheme to use is up to you. You could use strict consistency, which is whenever you get a buy request, okay, this or maybe new items arrive in stock, okay, this database broadcasts to all of the replica saying this item is invalid. Okay, so they will then discard it from the cache. Or you can use time to live, saying I'm going to cache it for the next 5 requests and then I'm going to check whether it has changed. Okay. The mechanism is up to you, but you have to implement caching and have some form of cache consistency. Okay, that's the first part. Yes, question. So in this case, no failures. So part two will have failures. Okay, here you are just using replication. So you, as I said, you can do replication for performance and high availability. Part one is replication and caching for performance. Okay. So part two is we'll use replication to do failures, in particular Byzantine failures. Okay, so what you have to do here is this part is identical. Okay. In part one, the database is not replicated, only tier one. Okay. In part two, we'll also replicate the database. Yeah, so here you will have in particular only the, let's say, the catalog server. You don't have to do both, but you are welcome to. Okay? So let's say 2, 3. So catalog server is now replicated on. I'm just showing disks, but these are machines. Okay? But unlike here, we are going to use replication for fault tolerance, not for performance. So every request that comes in here, okay, is sent to all three replicas, not just one. In this case, every request is only sent to one. Okay. Here, every request is sent to all three. Okay. All three are going to execute the request, send back the results, and then you do a vote. Okay. So if all three replies match, that's the reply you send back. But if you are assuming that any one of them can be Byzantine faulty, which means that it's going to send garbage results. Okay. So to show this, what you will do is you will actually pick one of these machines and basically corrupt the database, write random values to the items in stock. So it is going to send results that don't match with the other two. Okay, so you have to send the request to all three, get back the response, and then do voting and figure out what is the right response and send it back to one of these guys. Okay? So that is basically, so we'll not really have crash failures. We'll have Byzantine failures where one of them starts to malfunction. It produces wrong results. That you catch with this is the dispatcher. Okay. Yes, question.
In both cases, the part one load balancer and the dispatcher all have single nodes.
Yes, they are single. Now, you can obviously have them as all processes on one machine. All that doesn't matter. Okay. Because we are just doing this to understand how to build scalable systems with replication and fault tolerance. Okay. Is this clear?
And
so two parts.
There are no crash failures at all.
There are no crash failures, only Byzantine failures. And it's assumed that the dispatcher is not seeing any faults. Only the catalog database can see Byzantine faults. Yeah.
And it's up to us to decide which.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of creativity is up to you. How do you decide who fails, what caching policy to use, and so on. But that's the specification. Okay, yes, question.
In fact, we have, when the dispatcher sends a depend on the git has received response from git.
So you have to wait for all responses, compare the result, construct the right response and send it back to tier 1. To whoever made the request. Because tier 1, only one of them is making the request. So you will send it back to that tier, that machine. Okay? Alright, so let's stop here.